Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here, and sitting across from me, insisting to be called beloved home co-host, is Mike Cosentino.
Yes, he is. He's here. He's waking. He's doing great. And we're going to have a great topic this morning and a great guest, Sasha Abramski.
He's been on the show before.
Was such a hit before. So that's why, I mean, if we can call, we can say this is a guy that talks about poverty and hunger and prisons is a hit, but here we are. But it's a reality, and it's a sad one. So we're going to do a little old school journalism about prisons and poverty this morning. And Sasha's got done some extensive writing on that.
Yeah, he's written several books on it. American Furies: Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment. And mass imprisonment is an important phrase there. Hard Time Blues: How the Public Built a Prison Nation.
Yeah.
And Ill-Equipped: U.S. Prison and basically mental illness. And I think we'll try to get to the mental, how many people in our prisons are suffering from mental illness at some point in the show.
I would trust to say the name of your, first of all, say good morning, and then say the name of your newest book.
Good morning, and I'm glad you introduced me as a hit talking about doomsday topics. My newest book is called The American Way of Poverty: How the Other Half Still Lives.
With the underline, as Mike pointed out last time, of still lives. In other words, things have not changed so much since the 1960s. In fact,
they've
gotten
worse.
Well,
the book's title, How the Other Half Lives, was a book in the turn of the last century by a man called Jacob Riis. It was a book of photographs and written testimony about life in the New York slums 100 years ago. And my book was very much intended to show that there are similarities not just with the 1960s, but if you go all the way back to the turn of the 20th century, a lot of what we're seeing today is actually a resurgence of some of what muckraking journalists 100 years ago were writing about.
So it's like the issues have come around on a spiral. They're not exactly the same as they were 100 years ago. But they're still, but they still come up again, and particularly, I think crime and poverty is very current subject that has to be examined. And I guess what we want to talk today, folks, is about the connection between crime and poverty. Everybody sort of knows it in the back of their mind. I'm not sure Mike is ever going to get his headset on, but I'm not sure everybody understands the full dimension of it, that the United States has the largest prison population per capita in the world, that sentences for crimes in the U.S. are longer than those in such progressive places as Russia and China.
I used to say that I thought, and we live in a place called Yavapai County, Arizona, and we have such an aggressive large prison population. The Yavapai County authorities won't be happy until everybody in Yavapai County has a prison record.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that progressive sociologists about half a century ago started writing about was the military-industrial complex, and it was a phrase that President Eisenhower had actually used in his farewell speech when he left the White House. And Eisenhower had gotten very concerned that there was this network that was emerging of lobbyists, of defense contractors, of the military, and of all of the organizations that had a vested interest in ever-increasing expenditures on defense. And he warned that it had this extraordinarily dangerous potential to undermine democracy, and he called it the military-industrial complex. And after Eisenhower left office, a lot of progressive economists, a lot of progressive sociologists began analyzing modern American society through that lens. And if you fast forward a half century, in many ways it makes sense to talk about a prison industrial complex, that there are a whole bunch of players in the modern economy and in the modern polity that have a stake in keeping prison populations large. And you're talking about central Arizona. I've been to towns like Florence in central Arizona, where you have federal detention facilities, you have Marshal Service detention facilities, immigration detention facilities, then you have private prisons run by companies like Corrections Corporation of America, then you have state prisons, and then you have local jails. And when you put all of it together, you have a tremendous, tremendous amount of money flowing through prison systems and through prison contracts. You have a tremendous number of people with jobs involved in prisons and in the criminal justice system. You have a tremendous number of technology companies with their contracts based around prison technology and security. Now, one of the consequences of the emergence of a prison industrial complex is that there's this divorce between what the real crime rate is and what the incarceration rate is. Now, you talked about us having longer and larger prison longer prison sentences, larger prison populations than Russia and China. America does. In the 21st century, America has one quarter of the world's prisoners. Now, you'd think that meant it had one quarter of the world's crime. It doesn't. In actual fact, America's crime rate by many levels is lower than most other countries. Certainly its property crime rates. Its violent crime is a bit different. But its property crime rates are not particularly high, and its drug crime rates are not particularly high. What is high is the rate of incarceration in response to drug crimes. And that's one of the most extraordinary stories of the last 40 years, is that no other democracy has chosen to deal with public health crises like drug addiction primarily through incarceration. No other country has chosen to use mental health as a way into the criminal justice system. All of this is uniquely American at the moment.
Why don't you repeat that again for folks?
Well, what I'm saying is that there is no other country which has tried to incarcerate its way out of a drug crisis. There's no other country that said, all right, we have a problem with cocaine and heroin and all these other drugs, and our first tier of response is going to be long prison sentences. But we saw that from the 1970s in America, the series of mandatory sentencing laws. So you saw it in New York with the Rockefeller drug laws. You saw it in Michigan with these essentially life sentences for low-end drug criminals. You saw it throughout the South. You saw it with the federal drug codes in the 1980s, that one law after another was passed, making it more likely that low-end drug offenders would end up serving decades behind bars. And the single biggest driver, the single biggest reason that states like Arizona have seen this explosion in the number of people living behind bars and this explosion in the amount of public dollars being spent to lock them up, the single biggest reason is because we as a country have chosen to respond to drug addiction primarily through incarceration. Now, the other huge thing behind incarceration, you talked about it in the introduction, is the fact that increasingly our mental health services in the community are so dilapidated that people who are poor don't get access to mental health treatment until they go to jail or prison, which is why Cook County in Chicago and L.A. County and Rikers Island in New York, these are the three biggest mental health service providers in America. Our jails and our prisons are now becoming our mental health service systems. Now, you asked, and you said in the introduction, maybe we talk about what percentage of our prison population are mentally ill. It's a really, really hard number to work out because there are all these different studies, all these different calculi. But by most measures, somewhere in the region of a quarter of our prisoners are seriously mentally ill, and for women prisoners, it's higher than that. Now, that's an extraordinary waste of resources because it's far cheaper and far more effective to treat the mentally ill in the community.
The statistics I see are 80% on death row. Now, that's obviously a narrow population, but 80% of those on death row are
Death row population's a little bit separate because
violent.
The kind of crimes that result in someone going to death row in any country in the world would result in that person being locked up, maybe not on death row, but being locked up for a long period of time.
That's true.
But what's more extraordinary is the fact that lower-level prisoners are in prison primarily because of untreated mental illness.
Oh, it's insane.
And the second part of this is untreated mental illness combined with extreme poverty. If you come to California, for example, California in the early 90s passed this extraordinarily tough three strikes and you outlaw And the law was passed because the public was outraged about repeat offenders who were coming out of prison on parole, were committing horrible crimes, saying in some cases very, very horrible crimes. And the public wanted a law that would protect the general population from predatory repeat offenders. But the bill was so badly worded that it basically locked up anybody convicted of a third offense for 25 years to life. And there was this rash of cases where low-end, oftentimes mentally ill offenders were being put away for 25 years for things like stealing a pizza or stealing some golf clubs from a sports store or stealing a series of video cassettes. Now, that made no moral sense at all. But the other thing it made no sense was no fiscal sense, because what you're basically saying is, look, we have this low-level offender, and we're going to spend $1 million or $2 million over a lifetime to lock that offender up. And that's taxpayer dollars. And we're going to spend all that money to lock that person up in a high-security prison to provide them high levels of mental health services and so on and so forth, when all of that could be done at a fraction of the cost on the outside in a coordinated, secure community environment. And so I think one of the things that happened over the last 40 years is a lot of the collateral consequences of poverty, drug addiction, untreated mental illness, a lot of those things began to be seen as the responsibility of the prison system. And so we ignored them on the outside. We shredded our social safety net. We dismantled welfare programs. We got rid of job training programs. We did all these things to cut spending on the poor on the outside. But we didn't save any money because we ended up spending at least that much money locking people up for long periods of time and building up these massive prison systems. And to me, that's, you know, one of the great stories, or one of the most fascinating stories of the last part of the 20th century and the first part of the 21st, is the juxtaposition, the overlap between American poverty and American criminal justice policy. And the fact that America went on this jag, this sort of fairly unique jag around mass incarceration, at the same time as it dismantled its anti-poverty infrastructure. And I think the two are totally related. And if you fast forward 100 years or 200 years, a historian in the 22nd century, I suspect looking back at our era, will find that the story of American poverty and the story of American criminal justice, that those are two of the central ways of understanding 20th and 21st century American life.
Yeah, the chapter in history book is going to say, if, you know, 2014, if you're poor, go to jail. It's a crime to be poor in this. But Arizona was on track. I want to get this statistic in, to spend more on corrections, on prisons, than it was on education. Now, part of it is because education, they've cut so much out of the budget, and education is such a big part of the budget because there's nothing left in the budget, except the schools. It becomes a larger part, and even then it's being cut like mad. But this, with all of this going on, especially, once again, especially in a state like Arizona, we've heard this statistic on the show before, but I'm happy to say it every week if I have to. The largest mental health facility in this county is the Yavapai County Jail. The largest mental health facility in the country is the L.A. County Yep. Jail. That's where we send our mentally ill. And with all of this mass incarceration, as you call it, you'd think we'd have a totally safe society. We should be walking around, leaving our cars unlocked, our houses unlocked. But it's not.
This is one of the crazy things about mass incarceration. It actually doesn't tend to stop things like mass shootings. The things that terrify us as a community, the things that inspire our nightmares, tend to be anomalous crimes. The mass shootings in schools tend to be anomalous crimes. The mass shootings in malls, they tend to be these anomalous, unpredictable crimes. It's very, very hard to generate criminal justice responses that limit those kind of crimes. It'd be far more effective to have meaningful gun control measures and meaningful background checks before you can purchase guns. That would have a meaningful impact on mass shootings. But mass incarceration doesn't. Mass incarceration has an effect on some forms of crime, but it doesn't have an effect on the stuff of our nightmares terribly. But the other thing is that about 30 years ago, when the country was in the middle of the crack epidemic, and when a lot of cities were absolute war zones because there were gangs fighting for control of drug turf, about 30 years ago, you could say, well, it would make sense to try to raise incarceration somewhat, to try and tamp down these gang activities and these turf wars and so on. And maybe it did. Maybe in the 1980s there was room to increase the prison population rationally. But if you go into the 1990s, from the early 90s on in, most forms of crime start falling. And most criminologists who studied it say that the majority of the reason for the crime decline isn't to do with mass incarceration. It's to do with a host of other factors. It's the fact that in the early 90s, unemployment, especially for young people, started to go down. It's to do with the fact that drug markets in cities began to stabilize. The crack epidemic peaks and then falls off. There are many reasons. But by the early 90s, crime rates are going down year in and year out. It's one of these statistical marvels of the modern world. And yet, at the same time, incarceration rates are going up
in the
year
US.
In and year out. Now, even if you said, and it doesn't, it actually isn't true, but even if you accepted the fact that most of the responsibility for the fall off in crime was to do with incarceration, at a certain point, when the crime rates had gone down, you'd expect to see a stabilization and then a fall off in prison rates. But it didn't happen. From the early 90s until about 2010, every year the crime rate fell, and every year the incarceration rate rose.
No, I think the conservative zones,
a lot of states did begin reducing their prison population, but they didn't do it because they'd had a moral epiphany. They began reducing their prison populations because of exactly what you said a few minutes ago. They realized they'd run out of money, and they'd realized that unless they started reducing their prison population, they would have to cut schools and universities to the bone and then beyond the bone. And that didn't work with voters. And that's when you start seeing the beginning of a fall off of mass incarceration, because we had spent so much money locking people up that we no longer had enough money to educate our children. And it just didn't make any sense at all at that point.
The conservative argument would be that the mass incarceration worked and that we reduced crime because of it, that there's a direct connection between putting people in jail for very, very long periods of time. And probably we don't care whether it's a serious offense or not. If they're off in jail, they're not committing crime.
Well, I would two responses to that. One of them would be, even if you accept that argument, as I said, at a certain point, a few years after the fall off in crime rates, you would have seen a reduction in incarceration as well, even with long prison sentences. If there was a rational mechanism in play linking crime rates to incarceration rates, at a certain point, you'd have seen a big fall off in incarceration, and that didn't happen. But the second thing is a matter of civil liberties, which is that if you create an incarceration structure large enough, yes, logically, you can bring down crime rates. If you incarcerate a majority of young people, let's say, logically, there are so few people out there, you can reduce crime rates. But at what cost to society? At what cost to our moral fabric?
Well, that's
and
it.
I think, you know, this is one of the crucial questions here, which is that during the Cold War, one of the ways America rhetorically positioned itself as being different and better than the Soviet Union was the fact that the Soviet Union had a gulag, the fact that the Soviet Union mass incarcerated its own population. And time and again, our political leaders said, democracies do not do that. That is one of the distinguishing characteristics of democracies, is that they do not wholesale incarcerate. And that one of the distinguishing characteristics of authoritarian systems is they do mass incarcerate. Now, that was true back in the 60s. And it remains true today with one exception. If you look around the world, almost every democracy in the world has a fairly low and fairly constant incarceration rate. The one exception is the United States, which has an incarceration rate about five times higher than England, Germany, Canada, Australia, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, etc., etc. The one exception to that rule is America, which has mass incarceration now, not just in the federal system, but in most of the 50 states. It has an incarceration rate higher than that of Russia. It has an incarceration rate higher than that of China. And it's obviously racially overlapped as well. African American and Latino populations are incarcerated at a far higher rate than a white and Asian populations in the United States. Young African American males in the South have the highest incarceration rate of any demographic in the world. The single two highest incarceration rates in the world are black men in Louisiana and black men in Mississippi. That's an extraordinary, extraordinary story. If you're a young man in New Orleans or you're a young man in Jackson, Mississippi, you are far more likely to go to prison than you are to go to college or to complete college. you're far more likely to spend 4 years in prison than to spend 4 years in college. Now, by every measure, that's a misinvestment in human resources. It's a misinvestment in our future. And to me, that's a central part of the story of what we are becoming as a community at the moment, is we're underinvesting in all the things that can make us a fairer and more equitable society. We're underinvesting in healthcare for poor people. We're underinvesting in job training for poor communities. We're underinvesting in schools, in the K-12 education system for poor communities. And we're massively overinvesting in locking people from poor communities up. And that's a really, really fascinating transformation in how America functions as a society.
One of the things that they talk about, that one of the constants in prison populations, are reading levels. That below a third grade reading level, you're going to go to jail in America. And yet, the you just talked about K-12 expenditures and being in this state, they were cut $2.8 billion in the last 4 years. From K-12 education, and virtually dooming a certain part of the population that to go to jail. One of the other things I want to talk about, we talked about certainty versus severity when it comes to sentencing, and that you went back to the 80s and 90s and talked about the legal criminal justice system then. And there may be some room for criticism there, that there was maybe a lack of certainty in going to jail, but rather than increasing, commit a crime, have some sort of certainty that you would do at least some time in jail, or at least pay for that crime, they came up with these incredibly severe sentences, these three strikes laws, these sentences that doomed entire families to poverty. And then the cycle of crime. Places, I don't want to doom our Arizona towns or slander them in any way, but those prison towns where the families of those people are around and suffering in poverty because one, two, or three of the breadwinners in the family are in the local prison, suffer immensely. And the crime rates are sometimes much higher than other places, and including our own community. We have a county prison down the road, and a casino. I'm not sure which prison is which is worse, but at least as far as putting families going from crime to poverty, poverty to crime, that cycle. When you take that breadwinner, you take those family members, and put them in jail for crimes that should be treated, as you say, rather than incarcerated.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things, especially around drug crimes, there's a public health language and a public health model that's emerged over the last 30, 40 years. And the public health language essentially is based around the premise of do no harm. And it's a very easy principle to grasp, which is that any public policy response to addiction should do more benefit to the individual and the community than harm. Now, obviously, if you have an individual, some people on drugs are totally dysfunctional, very violent, and very criminally prone. That's a different matter. But if you have a person on drugs who is also a breadwinner for a family, the do no harm principle would say, well, get that person into treatment. Do everything you can to keep that person in the community in structured treatment. Allow them to keep their job, allow them to keep paying taxes, exactly. Allow them to keep supporting their family. That's the public health response. The criminal justice response, especially in the 80s and 90s, was take that person and lock them up.
Right.
Even if it means that they, instead of being a breadwinner, become a ward of the state, a very expensive criminal justice ward of the state, even if it makes their families destitute, even if it takes a parent out of a kid's home. And it doesn't work. What it does is it breaks community. And that's why you see over the last 5-10 years an increasing number of political leaders stepping forward and saying, look, this policy is broken. It doesn't work. We need reform. That goes from conservative ex-governors like Gary Johnson in New Mexico, who's argued for drug legalization, through to some of the initiatives we've seen, especially in Western states in recent years, decriminalizing marijuana. And all of those, what they have in common is a public health approach to drug policy. It's a much more sensible, much more nuanced approach than what was put in place in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. But the tragedy is that it isn't being implemented across the board. It's being implemented in sort of fits and starts. You still have a tremendous number of people serving absurd prison sentences for low-end crimes. The most egregious example is a man called Weldon Angelos, and I've interviewed him. He was a young man arrested in Salt Lake City about 10 years ago for marijuana dealing, and he was alleged to have had a gun while he was doing the dealing, but not to have used the gun. And because he had a gun, it triggered federal mandatory sentences, and he was sentenced to 55 years with no parole. And the judge sentenced him and then said, this is the most outrageous sentence I've ever had to impose. I urge a presidential pardon. And George Bush didn't give a pardon, and so far Obama hasn't given a pardon. And Angelos lives in Lompoc in a federal penitentiary in California, and he's going to be there till he's 80. Wow. And he has several kids, and he has a wife, and their lives are all in limbo at the very least.
Right.
And his life is largely destroyed. And he's had senators speak on his behalf, congressmen, heads of the FBI, ex-heads of the FBI, attorneys general. Nobody who studied this case thinks that Angelos merited a 55-year sentence, including the judge who sentenced him. But the laws are so inflexible that he stays in prison.
Wow.
And I think that, you know, when you hear stories like that, and he's not alone. I've interviewed middle-aged men in Alabama who are serving life for marijuana offenses. I've interviewed people all over the country serving extremely long periods, decades, for low-end drug offenses, many of them in solitary confinement units. And when you hear these stories, it really is a sort of kick in the teeth, in a sense. It really does challenge the sense of justice, because it isn't, Angelos' story isn't a just story.
Let me tell you the way I see it working in Yavapai County and what I suspect the rest of Arizona. It's an underground thing. It's there are programs, but they are implemented. They are created by staff. There is no political will, none here, because of the Tea Party influence, because of the conservative, the right-wing influence. There is no political will to announce or to put in place or to let the public know about the programs that are going on. But day after day, I have this faith, and these people that I know, these are people that are my friends and neighbors in the criminal justice system in Arizona, and these programs that you're talking about, these treatment programs, These programs to keep families together are happening right here, but they're all underground.
Yeah, I think it goes beyond criminal justice, that one of the things that I find most interesting when I study poverty and when I talk to people working around poverty in the country is there's a lot of really interesting, innovative programs being done locally.
Yes.
Being done
exactly.
Even sometimes federally, but they're very, very below the radar.
That's right.
Yeah. Oregon being a case in point. Oregon's done some really creative stuff around healthcare access and around trying to improve education spending. California just passed an increase in the minimum wage, very significant increase in the minimum wage. A lot of local credit unions and community credit unions have done very interesting things around trying to keep people in their homes when they're at risk of foreclosure. So there is really interesting programming being done. There are microcredit systems being set up to try and channel money into poor communities. But the political will to create an umbrella, the political will to create, if you like, the moral energy to federalize it, the political will to make this a national priority, that's what's lacking at the
exactly.
moment.
Exactly. Sasha, real quickly, explain microcredit,
a microcredit system is very, very simple, and it's done in a lot of much poorer countries in America, which is basically the idea that very, very small amounts of money, $50, $100, $1,000.
Exactly.
If you lend them to somebody who's trying to start their own business in a low-income community, can have a huge impact. That you can take a person with almost no economic prospects and you can give them the money to buy basic things, tools for a job, maybe a computer, that you can buy, you can basically change their lives very profoundly with a little amount of cash.
Exactly.
So in a lot of poor communities, Milwaukee being a case in point, for example, there's very interesting microcredit systems being set up for low-income women in particular.
Yes.
Now, one of the other things you could do with microcredit, one of the things that is so detrimental to people in poverty is their access to credit, that the poorer you are, the less likely you are to have a credit card, the less likely you are to have a bank account, a savings account, and so on. So when you need to borrow, you generally borrow from informal sources. So at one level, it's pawnbrokers. You take,
right.
you take some of your possessions and you pawn it off. But the more nefarious model is the payday loans. You go in, you say, I need to borrow $50 or $100, and I'll borrow it against my next paycheck. And you borrow it for a short amount of time, 14 days or 30 days. And it comes with a huge number of fees. If you pay it all off in 1 month, maybe you're lucky and you get away with $20 or $30 of fees. But if you can't pay it off, each month or each two-week period, those fees accumulate, and they serve as interest rates. They're not called interest rates, but to all intents and purposes, payday loans come with these vast interest rates. And if you annualize it, you work out what the interest rate is for a payday loan unpaid over a year. And it's about 500%.
You got guys on TV advertising that actually after 2 years of paying on your loan with our company, your loan will be paid off. With their company, you'll still have the original amount of the loan because
they're proud. Very unsavory advertisements, which are essentially snake oil advertisements.
And they're saying, well, we're better than they are because you only have to pay 2 years of interest on, you know, on this tiny principal on your loan.
That's absolutely outrageous. I've spoken to a large number of people who take these payday loans and they can never pay them off. It's basically just a complete trap. And a microcredit system is a way around that because you can basically provide legitimate non-profit loans into poor communities using these well-established models, and it bypasses the for-profit payday loan system.
And I'm not sure there's any documents on this, but I know the conservatives counted on it, and I believe it anyway, that in Arizona and in other places, especially in rural Arizona, rather than this huge system that was way too expensive, or the nefarious system, as you called it, they're going to family. They are, you know, this is why your kids never leave you. This is why
it's true that, you know, for young people in America today, so many parts of the economy are broken. And it's not just in America. If you look at European unemployment rates for young people, in some countries, half of young people, in Spain, for example, half of young people are unemployed. That the last 10 years has been calamitous economically to the generation coming of age after 2008.
Well, it makes sense because we share an economy and we share that problem in those economies.
Yeah, so the question then becomes, how do you deal with it? You know, if parts of our economy are broken, if parts of our economy were so impacted by what happened in the years leading up to and surrounding 2008 that they're just non-functional, how do we fix it?
Well,
one of the things that clearly has to be done is job training for young people, better access to affordable higher education for young people, so young people aren't coming out with tens of thousands of dollars of student debt. There are all kinds of ways that we as a society could target specific groups to try and help them economically. And we're choosing not to do so. We're choosing the easy option, which is to basically put our heads in the sand and say, well, look, let's hope it goes away. Let's hope that 5 or 10 years from now things are better. But we're not putting in place programs that are likely to make things better. And that's one of the things I write about in my book. We know these programs work. We know that things like microcredit work. There's a whole bunch of evidence it works.
Minimum wage.
We know that making higher education affordable works. But we're not doing these things.
Congress has raised their salary 15 times in the last since 1994. They've raised the minimum wage 3 times. Right now, there's a huge push, and I support it every chance I get, and I mention it every chance. $11 at Lego. Obama came into office promising a $9.50 minimum wage. That was in 2008. And that would have been fine in 2009. Now in 2013, they crunched the numbers, and somewhere between $10.50 and $11.50 would be a living wage. And that's the push. The other thing that you and I talked about, matter of fact, it's headlines in today's paper, is the Robin Hood tax or the financial transaction tax. They have a different name for it in Europe. Germany is calling for a financial transaction tax. And of all the countries, we're not talking about the leadership now, we're talking about the people. In Switzerland, they're having a vote this very moment, today, to limit the pay of CEOs.
Well, the other thing in Switzerland is they've actually passed a basic income guarantee recently, I believe. And, you know, there's all kinds of creative thinking being done on these issues, which is that affluent countries have enough money to bring people out of poverty through things like basic income guarantees. And affluent countries have enough money to create huge pools for anti-poverty programs through things like the Robin Hood tax or the financial transaction
tax.
Let's
explain what that
is. And it's a very easy concept. I mean, you know, in case some of your audience isn't familiar with it, it's the idea that in an era in which computers do automatic stock and bond and other financial trades at warp speed, when every day billions of invisible trades are being done, which really don't benefit the broader economy in any way, shape, or form. They're all about arbitrage. They're about finding profit on the margins. In that kind of a society, why not have a minuscule tax, 0.25%, let's say, a minuscule tax on trades, but because so many are being done, it would generate large amounts of money. And traditionally, the argument's been, well, we can't do it because if we do it and other countries don't, markets will move to those other countries. Well, that might be true for a small country. But when the biggest economy in the world embraces a financial transaction tax, it carries weight. And America at the moment is the biggest economy in the world. So America has tremendous leeway to create innovative programs like the financial transaction tax. And if it does so, making it easier for countries like Germany, Britain, France, the secondary markets to follow suit. And once they follow suit, obviously then the tertiary markets can follow suit. So one of the privileges of power, one of the privileges of size, is it allows us to be tremendously creative economically. Roosevelt realized this in the 1930s, and he embraced government borrowing. He embraced Keynesian economics, and he put millions of Americans back to work using these unorthodox economic methods. Roosevelt understood that in the 30s. Lyndon Johnson understood it in the 1960s when he created the Great Society programs. Somehow in the last 30, 40 years, as a society, we've lost our will to get creative to tackle poverty. One of the consequences of that is we've left millions of people out of our story. We have 50 million Americans in poverty today, and we don't talk about them. Our political leaders don't talk about them. Our political processes don't address their needs. We talk about the struggling middle classes, and that's an important part of the story, but it's an incomplete one. We don't talk about the working poor. We don't talk about the unemployed. We don't talk about the underemployed. We don't talk about people mired in intergenerational poverty. They've been left out of our modern American story. It seems to me that we have an obligation, not just me as a journalist. I mean, journalists always are looking for interesting stories. But as a society, it seems we have a moral obligation to reincorporate into our story these 50 million Americans, and they've been ignored for way too long as a part of our national mosaic.
And there's 50 million of them. It's not like a few. I'm not going to quote John F. Kennedy. I'm going to paraphrase him because I can't quote him. That if we don't care for the many in our society that are poor, nobody can save. And I love that word. I love the word save, the few that are rich. If we don't care for the poor, we can't save the rich.
Kennedy, it was part of his inauguration speech in 1961. And Kennedy made this extremely, in a sense, intuitive leap here, which is that a society functions best when it addresses the needs of everybody. A society starts to fray, and it starts to fray very quickly, and it starts to create all kinds of political crises when it ceases to address the needs of a large part of the population. And that was the premise behind Kennedy's inauguration speech, and it was most certainly the moral premise behind Lyndon Johnson's State of the Union speech 50 years ago this coming January. January 1964, when the new president commits the moral authority of the United States to racial justice through the Civil Rights Act, and to economic justice through the war on poverty. Because Johnson had this profound understanding that the society would fray if large demographics were left out of the main narrative.
That's what's happening.
And that's what's happening today. And, someone I talked to called Marshall Gantz called it the miner's canary. Yeah. The miners in the old days had canaries that would drop dead at the first hint of gas, and it was a warning sign to get out of the mine. And Gantz said to me, that's what modern-day poverty is. It's the warning sign that something is going wrong in the body politic.
I think one problem is that people are ashamed of being poor. They're ashamed of not having
absolutely
money. And Americans are extremely inventive, and they can borrow money from friends, and they can go to food banks, and they can do 1,000 things to try to ameliorate their situation. But that aside from that, all the work people are trying to do to cope, the two jobs and the rest of it, it's a larger problem for society, not just for the individuals. And that, you know, when we blame poverty on the people who are poor, and we blame crime to some extent even on the criminals, because we're setting up a situation where there are a tremendous amount of poor people with very small prospects. And one thing that I got when I lived in New York, right during the 80s and 90s, when there was an incredible amount of crime, was the ingenuity and effort that was put into criminal enterprise that could have been used usefully. The guy who hung down and broke into the woman above me apartment dropped onto a ledge 11 feet, you know, 11 feet below the roof.
Yeah.
I've told that story, but there's a guy who should be in the Marine Corps or something. Yeah. He shouldn't be a criminal. And you have all these people with a lot of talent, a lot of aggressive energy. And there's no form for them, and then it becomes counterproductive.
It's but he had a felony record. He couldn't get a job in America. One out of four have a felony record in this country, as we talked about, because of the mass incarceration.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few things going on there, which is, you know, number one, it makes way more sense to put in place programs that very significantly limit people's turn to crime in the first place. Now, that again, you know, in the same way, there'll always be some level of poverty. There'll probably always be some level of crime, that some people, for various reasons, are going to turn to crime. But as a society, we want to create programs and we want to create opportunities and we want to create a sense of community that minimizes the numbers who turn to crime.
Exactly.
But then the second thing you're talking about, this sort of creation of a permanent underclass, that if you provide a felony record, which serves as a modern scarlet letter, if you end up in a situation where millions and millions of Americans have felony records, oftentimes for very, very low-end drug offenses. Well, those people, when they come out of prison, have extraordinarily difficult times accessing work. Employers don't want to hire them. In many cases, employers aren't allowed to hire them because you're not allowed in certain industries and certain professions to hire people with felony records. In many states, you can't get licenses for an array of jobs if you have felony records. And in many, many states, if you have a felony record, you can never in your life again vote. You can never participate politically. Now, if you end up in a situation where millions and millions of people are, in a sense, disenfranchised both economically and politically from the broader community, well, you're creating a modern-day underclass. You're creating people with almost no opportunity to succeed legitimately. And it's deeply counterproductive because what it means is you've got people who are on the margins. They have no legitimate access to jobs. They have no legitimate access to government assistance. They have no legitimate access to all the basics of life. And
so
then you have to spend a huge
amount
of money policing them and down the road incarcerating them. It's an extraordinarily expensive way to deal with social problems.
You've written three books on prison system in America, and you've written two books, I think, on poverty. If you had a one or two sentence in the last couple of minutes takeaway, what did you learn? Because if you read Sasha's book, he's out talking to the people who are poor. He's out talking to people who are in prison. He's not just doing statistical research.
Well, I think what I learned is that both when it comes to crime and punishment and when it comes to poverty, the stories are infinitely complex because they're stories of real people, not of stereotypes. And they're stories of real people caught in large forces. And sometimes they're stories of deeply flawed people, but sometimes they're stories of people just struggling to get by. And I think one of the things I learned was that you have to approach these stories with humility. And you have to be willing to learn about the complexities of people's lives. And you have to be willing to learn about the diversity of their stories. And one of the things that frustrates me when I hear politicians talking about poverty today, oftentimes they're not talking about real people, they're talking about stereotypes.
That's right.
When you have politicians talking about poor people living on the hammock of the social safety net, well, those are politicians who haven't talked to a family who misses meals. They haven't talked to a kid who goes to school hungry. They haven't talked to a single mother with two or three jobs who still is struggling to buy medicine for a sick child. And you only get those stories if you spend the time traveling around the country, talking to real people, and approaching them without judgment, approaching them without preconceptions. And that's what I learned from this, is that this is an enormously humbling, complicated challenge.
We want to thank Sasha Abramsky for being with us today. Your latest book, Sasha, is called
The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives.
It's available in bookstores. It's available online. Sasha has written a whole bunch of series of interesting books on these issues.
Articles and what?
I think we could do 10 programs on crime and poverty and not get at the connection. But
well, it might be back, and I'll get up early morning each time.
Okay, right. Thank you for being with us, Sasha.
Yeah.
All right, thanks so much.
Yeah, we indeed might want to talk some more about some of those stories, though.
Yes. Thanks for joining us on Democratic Perspective.
Yep.
Tune in next week. Go on to our website.
Yes, VVID.org. You will find this podcast and many, 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 many other fascinating podcasts. And we are broadcast live on the Internet.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.